Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, Chair of the Club's Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce the topic for this evening and our distinguished speakers. The topic is campaign finance reform and its effect on the environment. And rather than specifically focusing especially on Proposition 15, which is on the June ballot. Our two speakers, first is Dr. Trent Lang. He was president of the board of directors of the California Clean Money Campaign. Trent has served on the board of the California Clean Money Campaign since 2003. He also currently serves as chair of the Yes on Proposition 15 campaign for the California Fair Elections Act on the June ballot. He has been on the executive committee of two previous ballot campaigns in California and helped run the successful legislative campaign to get the legislature to pass and Governor Schwarzenegger to sign AB 583 in 2008, which had the effect of putting the California Fair Elections Act on the June 2010 ballot. Dr. Lang has a PhD from UCLA with a multidisciplinary academic background in computer science, and cognitive psychology, and is the author of over 20 academic publications. He is president and CEO of the Lang Fund Management, LLC, which runs a small but successful market-neutral hedge fund, and we will try not to hold that against him. Bill McGavern is our other speaker. He is he heads the Sierra Club California office in Sacramento. He has represented the group since 2000, advocating for environmental causes before the state legislature and executive agencies. His issue areas include air quality, global warming, toxics, recycling and solid waste, pesticides, enforcement, environmental justice, environmental health, and open government. Mr. McGavern received his AB in American Civilization, magna cum laude, and Phi Beta Kappa from Brown. After working in youth outreach, political campaigns, and alternative journalism, he received his JD degree, magna cum laude, from the State University of New York at Buffalo Law School, where he won the Faculty and Trial Techniques Awards. Mr. McGavern has worked as an environmental advocate since 1988, first in Washington, D.C., and then in California. Now, since my invitations to organizations representing the opposite point of view, specifically about Prop 15, have gone unanswered, I will do my best to ask the appropriate balancing questions. And since I'm a business school professor and a former banker for 20 years, I think I'm amply qualified to do that. If I ask rude questions, that's why. Just doing my job. So let's lead off with Bill McGavern of the Commonwealth Club, or excuse me, the Sierra Club, California. Bill, I was wondering if you could give our audience an idea of how our current method of financing political campaigns affects environmental issues.
Thanks, Kerry. I've been an environmental advocate for over 20 years, and I'm pleased to say I've always worked for organizations that have supported campaign finance reform, and I have consistently seen a connection between the way that campaigns are funded and the results that we get or often do not get from our elected officials. There is clearly a disconnect between what the voters want, whether you're talking about the state level or the national level, when it comes to environmental protection, and the policies that we get out of our elected officials. If you look at the public opinion surveys that are done consistently, you'll find that people say they want more environmental protection, not less. They want cleaner air, cleaner water. They want to get off of dirty energy and to clean energy. They want to preserve the beautiful places like the California coast and mountains and deserts. Yet, we don't see that very often translated into effective action from our state, federal, or local governments. Why is it that we still are addicted to oil and we let BP get off with very lax oversight of their offshore drilling? Why is it that companies are still allowed to sell products that have chemicals in them that are toxic for our children and for most of us? Why is it that in California, most people still live in places where the air is unhealthy to breathe during some of the year. This is not what the voters want. So we have a democratic system. I think it's structured fairly well, but it has one major flaw in it, which is the disproportionate influence of big money on politics. So I firmly believe that we're never going to be able to clean up our environment until we clean up our political system. Some of the best testimony on this actually comes from the elected officials themselves. It was Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts who once said that elected officials are the only people in the world who are expected to take large sums of money from complete strangers and give them nothing in return. I mean, you think about that. The businesses that are making these campaign contributions, they're not stupid, naive, or altruistic, right? They're motivated by the bottom line. That's, in fact, their duty to their shareholders to make good investments. So when they invest millions of dollars in elections, it's because they know that the return on that investment is really good for them. And that's why you see the Chevrons and the BPs and the Exxons putting so much money into campaigns. It's worth it for them. There was one senator who once said that you couldn't buy his vote, but you could rent it for a while. And unfortunately, we do see that renting going on. And there are others who will tell you, you know, look, you're not going to buy my vote with a $5,000 campaign contribution. And I think in most cases, that's true. But they will honestly tell you, and some of the most conscientious, former Senator Paul Simon from Illinois, who was a very public-minded, conscientious senator, he said, look, at the end of a long day, I get back to my office or my hotel room, and I've got a huge stack of messages. I've got to decide which are the calls that I return. And will it affect my decision-making? Which of those calls came from somebody who made a contribution to me? Of course it will. So the contributors are trying to buy access and influence, and they, in fact, are getting that. And I see this play out in the Capitol anytime that the legislature is in session. I can remember a time a few years ago when a legislator who has passed some of the most important laws in California to try to curb global warming was trying to pass a bill that would start moving us away from oil fueling our motor vehicles and towards alternative fuels. And she was talking with some of those legislators whose vote she needed to get off the floor, and she came back and said, you know, with them, it's just about the campaign contributions. If you look at the California legislature, it's pretty predictable on most votes. You've got a block of Democrats who are usually going to vote for the environment, and you know, you could say the same thing if you're talking about worker issues or consumer issues. You've got a block that consists of most of the Republican legislators who, you know, whether because it's their beliefs or who funds their campaign or their districts, are almost always going to oppose environmental measures. And that means the balance of power is held by a block of Democrats who they actually have organized themselves. Years ago, they first called themselves the Business Democrats. And that was actually kind of truth in advertising. And it was too truthful for them because what happened was in the next cycle of campaigns, there were primaries. And in California, the action in the legislature is always in the open seat primaries. Because we have term limits and because the incumbents have so much money, the seats only really are contested, for the most part, with just a few exceptions, when an incumbent has been termed out. So they're open. So usually in it'll be the Democratic primary or the Republican primary that will decide who's going to win. So there were a series of Democratic primaries where you had someone running as a business Democrat and someone running as, you know, an actual Democrat. And some of the more progressive forces were able to turn business Democrat into a term of opprobrium, which, you know, it rightfully belonged, not because there's anything wrong with business per se, but because these business Democrats, yeah, I realize I'm next to the business professor here. But the reason why these business Democrats organized themselves this way was literally so that they could collect campaign contributions from companies and in return to stop or weaken bills that would protect the environment, protect consumers, protect workers. That was their whole reason for being. So after some of the new candidates lost because they were branded business Democrats, then this bloc started calling themselves the moderate Democrats. Because, you know, what could be wrong with being moderate? Now I think they're calling themselves the new Democrats. But there's nothing moderate and nothing new about what they're trying to do. They simply take the campaign money and they will vote with those contributors as long as they think they can get away with it, which is usually when they think not that many people are watching, particularly people in their district. They will take that money and then use it. There are all kinds of ways they can use it. Now, a really good example of the power of money in the state capitol came last fall when there was a bill that was jammed through the legislature to benefit one particular project, which is a project of one particular billionaire. He wants to build a football stadium outside of Los Angeles in a place called the City of Industry. And he doesn't have a team yet, but he wants to build the stadium. And some of the local governments in the area and citizens group had filed a lawsuit under the California Environmental Quality Act. This guy actually got the legislature to legislatively give him an exemption from California's Keystone environmental law. He's a billionaire. He gives a lot of money to both parties. And he got the leadership, you know, in this case, the Democrats, who usually, you know, will at least tell you that they're defenders of the environment. They took that money and they passed that stadium exemption. And, you know, that was last year. They said it was going to create 18,000 jobs. You know how many jobs it's created so far? Zero, unless you count the lobbyists for the developer. You know, they did just fine. But there's still no team. There's still no stadium. It wasn't environmental law that was actually blocking it, but that was the song and dance that they were willing to buy into. When we interview candidates, because my organization makes endorsements in a lot of legislative and statewide races. And lots of times when we interview the candidates, we ask them what's their position on clean money reform because it's such an important issue for us. And many of them will tell us, oh, yeah, we absolutely have to have it. They are actually not that happy with the current system. They can't, of course, unilaterally disarm. So that's why it's important to have a comprehensive reform to free all of us from this. And, of course, no politician will tell you, oh, yes, well, on that one, I sold my vote. You know, obviously, that would be the end of their career. But I actually have had an experience of going into the office of a legislator, seeing if he would support an environmental bill, and having the staffer go back and check and say, oh, no, he promised Miller Brewing that he would vote no on that. And, I mean, the bill didn't even have anything to do with beer. But, you know, businesses line up, and this was one that knew they had access to this particular assembly member, and they managed to get his vote. Now, you may say, well, you know, you guys make endorsements, you play in politics, so isn't this all just fair and even? Well, let me give you a sense of the scale. We have a political action committee, so we actually can make campaign contributions. Our PAC right now has less than $5,000 in it. And believe me, we're not expecting that. That's typical for us in a two-year election cycle. We will spend between $5,000 and $10,000. For these business lobbyists, that's just one night. I mean, when the legislature is in session, most Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesday evenings, there are fundraisers being held right near the Capitol. I mean, this is one of the few things that keeps downtown Sacramento going. There are these fundraisers which are charging literally thousands of dollars a ticket. And I'm not at these events except, you know, one or two times a year, one of the legislators who's very friendly will, you know, ask me to come for free because they'd like to have a friendly crowd there. But the business lobbyists, they just make the rounds of these fundraisers. And it's so foreign to what regular people do. To give you an example, I, not for Sierra Club, but just in my individual time, yesterday was one of the hosts of a little house party to raise a little money for Barbara Boxer, who I think has been a very good senator for us over the years. And do you know how much the tickets cost? $25. I mean, in the Sacramento capital fundraising circles, there are never events where you get in for under $500. Because regular people don't go to these. They're only for the lobbyists. We figured, let's have an event that regular people could go to. And, yeah, it won't fund Barbara Boxer's campaign, you know, for a lot of TV spots or anything, but it brings people to participate in the process. And I think that one of the benefits of clean money reform is by trying to balance out the money, it will bring more people into the process feeling like they can have a voice that won't be just drowned out by the big money interests. So I'll close with just one more example of the abuses of the current system. There was, not that long ago in the state legislature, the chair of a very powerful committee who would actually call lobbyists for groups that had bills up before her committee and say, I see you have a lot of bills before my committee. I have an event coming up. An event is always code for fundraiser in Sacramento. And I'd really like to see you there. That's the kind of system that we have right now. We can't fix all of it, but we can make a very good start by passing clean money reform.
Thanks, Bill. And now I'd like to hear from Trent Lang on the subject of what are the mechanisms available to us in America generally through which we can reduce the impact of money in political campaigns before we get to Prop 15 specifically?
Well, the two main different mechanisms are attempting to limit campaign contributions and public financing of campaigns. Now, some people would love to be able to say, to put a cap on overall spending of candidates, to be able to say, look, you can't spend any more than $1 million in your campaign, so that that way there'd be a maximum level, there wouldn't be skyrocketing races and so forth. But the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, has said that's not the constitutional, that violates free speech. So that is that sort of option is completely off of the table at this point. What the Supreme Court has said is that you can have contribution limits of a certain level. So you can say that, for instance, for presidential candidates, that they can only receive $2,000 per contributor, because they've said that the state has a compelling interest in avoiding corruption or the appearance of corruption. And that has those sorts of limits have some effect. They do slow down the amount of fundraising to a certain degree, but as they say, money is like water, it always finds a way. When that happens, people max out to their contributors at these different fundraisers. The maximum amount are often tailored to what the maximum spending contribution limits are. But then money goes into independent expenditure committees and 527s and groups of that nature where there aren't any limits. And then you have outside groups that spend hundreds of thousands or millions or even tens of millions of dollars at the presidential level supporting or attacking or swift voting candidates. So that sort of system that they've been trying since the Watergate era has had some minor effect, but generally has not clearly not solved the problem. The sort of system that has had the most positive effect, that has held the most promise and has actually worked very well, is public financing of campaigns to provide an alternative. Rather than to try to shut off a flow of water, to instead provide water to those candidates who are dying of thirst, one might say, so that everybody has at least has relatively similar amounts of water, and you don't have a system where only certain people, the wealthy and those connected to wealthy donors, are able to run real campaigns and to dwarf the others. So that is what we've started to see work extremely well. Now we have in 8 states and 2 cities clean elections systems, or now fair election system or clean money systems, of public financing campaigns, full public financing campaigns that provide an alternative to the current system. In those states that started with Arizona and Maine in 2000, you have candidates that once they qualify by showing that they have a broad base of public support by gathering a large number of small campaign contributions, they are able to get enough money to run their campaigns as long as they then accept very strict spending limits, which usually mean that they can't raise or spend any money whatsoever beyond the public grants that they receive. And these systems have been extremely successful. In the state of Maine, you have their legislature with 83% of their legislature 85% now, that was elected with public financing, not spending a single dime of private money on their campaigns. So an amazing turnaround there. The state of Connecticut, which used fair elections for the first time in the year 2008, the system was so attractive and so powerful that 81% of their legislature was elected with public financing, not spending a single dime of private money on their campaigns. So though the systems have to be voluntary, the Supreme Court wouldn't let it be any other way, and it may not even be important to have it any other way. The systems are so strong and attractive that you have, you know, a super majority of legislators that are free of the influence of special interest money. And that's a real key, because you have two major different aspects of the problems. One is this whole issue of corruption that we've seen, or the appearance of corruption and people essentially renting their votes, as Bill said. And that's a terrible problem. But there's also another problem, and that is the problem of the voices that we actually get to hear when we are engaged in the campaign process. You know, how many times have we all heard people say that that their choice is between two levels of badness, and they're trying to pick the least worst candidate? Well, there's a reason for that. And the reason is that only certain candidates have enough money, or able to raise enough money, or are willing to raise enough money from special interests to be able to run their campaigns. And what fair elections public financing does, besides eliminating to a large degree that corruption aspect, is it allows new people to run for office. People who are not wealthy and do not have wealthy donors to be able to run real campaigns. And you see in these states a dramatically increased diversity of candidates and a dramatically increased level of competition, where incumbents actually have to pay attention to their constituents, because they better watch out. They are very likely to actually have a challenger that has as much money to spend on their campaigns as them. Now, incumbents will tend to have certain advantages, generally speaking, but if in a situation like that where they have competition, new people, they better pay attention to their constituents a lot more. And what you see in Connecticut and Maine and these other states is you actually see incumbents losing to new people sometimes. And that really helps reinvigorate the democracy and make sure that people pay attention to it. And in those states, you've seen dramatic changes in already the sorts of legislation that they're able to pass. So as both Maine and Arizona passed low-cost prescription drug care plans as soon as they had fair election systems. And Connecticut was a great example, and it's particularly apt for this particular forum, that Maine had Environmentalists in Connecticut had been attempting to expand their bottle recycling bill for over 10 years to match the new water bottles and green tea bottles and things like that. Every single year, it had been killed by lobbyists and by campaign contributions, over $100,000 in campaign contributions every year from the bottling companies. So, but in 2008, their legislature was elected with fair elections, 81%. The very first thing that they did in the January, the very first session, is that they took that bottle recycling bill up and they passed it. They expanded it to all the new kinds of bottles, and they changed it so that it actually increased revenue to the state by over $17 million a year. It's an amazing transformation. So sometimes people worry about the costs of public financing of campaigns. I think there is an example right there that shows that just that one bill, the savings from that one bill from a bottle recycling bill in Connecticut, more than paid for the entire cost of all public financing for all offices in the state of Connecticut. And just imagine all the other bills, and from environmental to tax bills and so forth, where the legislators did not have to worry about the corrupting influence or which campaign contributors were not going to contribute to them if they voted the wrong way. That's the sort of very positive change you start to see. So we're trying to now bring that sort of system here to California with Proposition 15.
Yeah, thanks, Trent. It's been said that it's useless to try to limit money because if you push it down here, it'll pop up over there. And that's what Bill and you both have alluded to. What would it take, without violating the First Amendment, to limit those independent committees, the swift voting kinds of, is there even a way to do that?
Well, there's no way constitutionally certainly with this Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would not allow any limits on independent expenditures or any limits on what millionaires or even, have we seen this year in California, what billionaires can spend on campaigns. But what you can do and what the Fair Elections public financing systems do is provide matching funds to participating candidates who are attacked by those outside groups, so that they can actually respond in kind. And the systems are set up in these states to provide these matching funds on a dollar-for-dollar basis up to a cap within 24 hours of the expenditure being made. And what that means is that you don't actually have to stop independent expenditures, because as long as the candidates themselves are able to respond and to fight back and say, look what they're trying to do, that's not true, in fact, they're the ones that have this problem or that, you find that it dramatically reduces the efficacy of those independent expenditures. And actually, you see in those states that there's a slowdown in them because they know they don't get free attacks, that they're actually going to – they better have something important to say, because they're just going to be giving their opponent a chance to respond.
Bill, do you have something to say on that?
Yeah, a couple of things to add about that. For a long time, campaign reform was about limits, about limiting campaign contributions and, in some cases, trying to limit expenditures. So some people still think that that's what it's about. So when they hear about campaign reform, they think, oh, you're trying to curtail money. But as Trent said, that's actually not what clean money reform is about. It doesn't try to take directly anyway, take the dirty money out of the system. It tries to level the playing field by bringing in clean money. Ultimately, I think with the horrendous decision by the Supreme Court in Citizens United, we probably will need a constitutional amendment. So, you know, that's one answer to Kerry's question, is that the ultimate answer may well be a constitutional amendment. Now, that obviously is a long-term solution. It's really difficult to amend the Constitution, especially in an area as controversial as this. But I know some organizations are already starting to work on that. Public Citizen, where I worked for 5 years in the 90s, I know they're launching a campaign on that. So I think it's one piece to keep your eye on.
Thank you. And in California, I'm continually amazed about the propositions and how they get on the ballot in the first place, and who pays for all this stuff and the really large amounts of money they get spent, not always by people in California either, promoting their own agenda. So what is the proposition or the initiative and referendum equivalent of a clean money limit or clean money financing, or is there such a thing?
Unfortunately, now there really isn't, and it costs $3 or $4 or sometimes $5 million to get an initiative on the ballot by paying signature gatherers. It's just virtually impossible in California to get one on by private citizenry anymore, and that's why you see such horrible ballot initiatives like the two that are put on the ballot this year by PG&E and Mercury Insurance, because they're the ones that have the money to put them on the ballot. The other alternative is for the legislature to put an initiative on the ballot itself, which sometimes you have to, of course, watch out for what the legislature is thinking when they're doing it. But sometimes it can actually happen through very positive, strong, steady grassroots pressure on the legislature to put the right thing on the ballot. That doesn't happen too often, but that's something that has happened this year for Proposition 15, as an example.
Thanks. And let's turn now to Proposition 15, which is the real tangible thing that we have on the ballot, and it relates to campaign finance reform. So I have a couple of questions about that. For those of you who haven't read your ballot proposition summary, Proposition 15 would only affect the Secretary of State office, and it would affect it for 2014 and 2018. That's when the Secretary of State office. But it also repeals the ban on public financing of elections. So a question for Trent specifically, who is chair of the Yes on 15 campaign, or whatever you're calling it. Why only the Secretary of State office, and why only two terms? Why not, if you're going to go to all this trouble of getting a clean money initiative passed, or why not just make it more general?
Well, certainly making it more general is the goal of a lot of people, certainly our organization and many of the people that were working for it. But sometimes you have to take one step at a time. That it's changing to a full clean money fair election system would be a dramatic change in the way elections are financed in Sacramento. It would be a complete change in the system. The powers that be, who have their power by giving because of their exclusive ability to give huge campaign contributions, would lose their position of power, and regular people would have the position of power. So if we had tried, if the grassroots folks and good government groups and others like the Sierra Club and other groups that pushed this on the ballot had tried to do everything at once, the combined forces of money in the state would have fought so hard it just would have been impossible, I think, to get it on the ballot. In addition to the fact that this is a tough budget environment. You want to start with something that's a small step and that has an affordable way to pay for it, which Proposition 15 actually does.
So it's kind of an experiment in a way. Let's make this for one office and prove that it can't.
Yeah, prove that it works. I mean, it is very true that the states that have had this states in two cities are all of them much smaller than California. So some people have the concern, will this actually be able to scale up to a state as big as California? We think that it clearly will. It's worked for offices as large as the governor of Arizona, which is a pretty gosh darn big office in itself. But if you prove that it works for a statewide office like the Secretary of State in California, and it's a critical, the Secretary of State office is a critical office because they are the referee of our elections. If there's any one office holder that you do not want to have to be beholden to private money, to sometimes money from their political party, it's the office of Secretary of State. So prove that it works with Secretary of State, change the system so that then you can expand it after that. That's the goal of Proposition 15.
I see. Now, shifting back to Bill McGovern of Sierra Club, California, for a moment, what are the key issues that relate to California specifically, environmental issues, which if we could institute some kind of better electoral mechanism might make a difference? Obviously climate change. What else?
I would say, and of course it's related to climate change and air pollution and a variety of other issues, is cleaning up our energy system, getting us off of oil and coal. People may not realize it because the coal isn't actually burned here in California, but our state gets about 15% of our electricity from coal-burning plants in other states. So the pollution goes to them, the electricity goes to us. We need to get off of those. I would say changing our patterns of development. And the developer lobby is so strong that they've been able to block any meaningful change in the way that we grow. And it's because of that that we've had unchecked sprawl in so much of the state, which causes freeway congestion and air pollution, water pollution, destruction of habitat and open space, and just makes the quality of life worse than it would be if we had more sensible and compact and livable community planning. So, I mean, I can go on. As environmentalists, we've got a long list of issues, toxics in our products, getting into our water and our food, better protection for our oceans and rivers and our forests, where right now the logging companies have been allowed to be regulated so laxly that a lot of the streams have been degraded in places like the North Coast. And the factory farming that goes on with huge amounts of pesticides and confined animal feeding operations that do great damage, particularly in places like the Central Valley. In any of these, when you look, you find a very powerful, well-funded business lobby that has got the allegiance of a lot of elected officials, and that allegiance is sealed through campaign contributions.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Bill. Staying with Bill for a moment, if there were a limit on campaign contributions, how would that affect your operation? You're an advocacy office. Would that curtail your freedom to operate?
No, it really wouldn't. First point I will make is that we support Prop 15, even though it will actually cost us some money, because the funding mechanism is to increase the lobbyist registration fee quite dramatically. So we have a couple registered lobbyists on staff, so you know we would have to pay more, but we think it's worth it for this experiment in clean money reform. And we, as I said, have a really small PAC. You know, I'd be happy to do away with it entirely if we could get rid of other PACs. You know, this system does not contemplate getting rid of PACs. It would just, as Trent said, make it possible for people to run for office without having to line up support from special interests. And this, to me, would be the biggest change, that it would enable people. I remember seeing a video that Bill Moyers made about campaign reform in Maine, and he was talking to someone who had been a waitress, and she ran for legislature and won. I mean, wouldn't that be something? And, you know, won without selling herself to the big companies. Wouldn't it be something if regular people could get elected to office on the strength of their own ideas, their own abilities, and the support that they're able to build within the community, instead of going out and finding people who can write them multi-thousand-dollar checks and will want something in return, or be independently wealthy, which is what a lot of our candidates are also.
That leads me to one of the questions asked by one of our audience members here, which has to do with Whitman and Poizner. And let's say that the type of limits that we have on the ballot for Secretary of State then also apply to governor. Would they be able to pour tens of millions of dollars of their own money into the campaign?
There's nothing in the fair election system that stops that. There's nothing that could. But what it would do, scaled up to the office of governor, is that, again, the fair elections candidates would – first of all, get enough money to run a reasonable campaign in the first place without having to raise money from anybody else. And second of all, they would get matching funds up to a pretty large level to be able to respond to those attacks. Now, would the system be able ever to keep up with a billionaire like Meg Whitman? Probably not. But it would provide more than Steve Poizner or the poor 100 millionaire who's having a hard time keeping up, or Jerry Brown have been able to do. Jerry Brown is out there you hardly ever hear from him because he's spending all this time fundraising trying to keep up with Meg Whitman, and there's just no way that he could. But so the Fair Elections candidates wouldn't have to do that. They would get a very large amount of money, a certain amount of matching money, and then be able to spend all their time making their case to the voters, which would make them so much better off than conventional candidates under the current system are. Much less the fact that not everybody is even quite as financially resource-connected as Jerry Brown is.
Thanks, Trent. And a question for either of you. In the states that do have public financing, I guess this is more for Trent, where does the money come from in Maine? And here we're gonna tax lobbyists, but what do they do in Maine?
Maine actually uses the general fund because they believe that it's something that fair elections and clean elections benefit the general good, and so the general good should pay for it, and that there's a huge payoff actually to taxpayers when the special interests aren't involved. But I can talk a little bit about in Arizona just as an example to show how little the systems really cost. The Arizona system is paid for entirely by a $5 tax checkoff on their state tax returns, just like the presidential system. That pays for half of the system, and by a 10% surcharge on civil and criminal penalties, mostly parking and speeding tickets. So we at the California Fair Elections campaign like to say that we certainly don't encourage speeding, but if you're going to speed anywhere, speed in Arizona, because at least you'll be supporting their clean election system. But that shows how small the cost is, generally speaking, for these systems. And then when you look at that example, for instance, of just that Connecticut bottle recycling bill that generated $17 million extra revenue for the state, the payoff is far, far beyond any small costs to the state for having the systems.
Thank you. Here's a very long question from an audience member, which I'm going to paraphrase. But first I'm going to make a statement in my role as devil's advocate. And that is that corporations in our society play the role of creating jobs and creating wealth for shareholders. And shareholders are not necessarily fat cats. They're people like people in this room. Our pensions are dependent on their stock prices and so forth, whether they're up or down. Were they up today? I don't know. Probably down. And so if we were successful, or if you were successful in completely stifling the corporate voice in the electoral process, wouldn't that be doing a disservice to the very people whose livelihood and wealth depends on the activities of corporations? And that's my question. I'm going to tag on this audience member's question, which is, if we reduce the corporate voice, what would be the appropriate mechanism for business interests to make their case for in the public process?
Well, the corporations will always have a voice to the extent that they represent workers, that they represent jobs and important products in the state, and there will always be lobbyists for businesses, and well, there should be. They should make the case for why certain laws are helpful to the jobs or to the economy of the state. But the key is that should be a battle of ideas, not a battle of money. So corporations will have their representation. Unions will have their representation. Everybody would be able to have their representation to the extent that their ideas and the policies that they advocate for are to the benefit of the majority of Californians. That's really the key, is that elections should be about ideas, not who has the most money, and so should government policy be about the best ideas and not the most money.
Here's a question for either of you. It says, civil rights, social security, the end of the Vietnam War came about due to social unrest. Do you think that campaign finance could be another issue? Should we be marching in the streets about this kind of issue?
Yeah, I think we should be marching in the streets. I think actually that's been one of the weaknesses of this movement is that it's not a top priority for enough people. You know, it's a top priority for Trent and a lot of people that he works with, But for a lot of other people, they don't realize that this is the reform that makes all the other reforms possible. And so we need to bump it up on people's list of priorities, and maybe we need to do something to make it more compelling. Certainly we've been trying. But I think it is going to take a strong public demand in order to get the reform that we need.
Maybe we need some kind of Watergate-type high-profile scandal. Although, didn't we have that? I don't know.
Well, it is true that both Arizona and Connecticut's clean elections laws did come into place, not coincidentally, after both of their governors were thrown in jail for corruption issues.
Aha. Did you want to add anything to the previous question?
I think he's absolutely right, is that people have their issues that they really, really care about. And one of the things that we've gained momentum on, I think, in the past year is that people have begun to see that no matter who is in power, the sorts of reforms that they want, be it in health care or finance reform or the environment or anything else, just are not going to happen until we fix our broken campaign finance system. And we've got a great chance for a small but critical step here with Proposition 15 on the ballot in a couple of weeks. But that's just a first step. And to get this expanded so that we can fix everything else, we are going to have to all work together and demand that they expand it to all other offices so that no politicians are in the fundraising game. And that's going to take everybody working together also.
Thanks. There's another ballot measure on the ballot, Proposition 14, which would do away with the segregated primaries and have an open primary. Do you think that could have? Is that what's? How does that and the campaign finance reform? Is there any overlap there? And how would that measure, if approved, affect environmental issues? Bill, if you could comment on that.
Let me preface this by saying that Sierra Club has no position on Prop 14, so I'm giving you my personal opinion. I think that Prop 14 would be a step backwards. It would give us the so-called top two primary, which is the system used in Louisiana, where the motto, drill, baby, drill, was very popular until a little over a month ago, and where many governors have gone to prison for corruption charges. I actually think that one of the problems with the top two primary is it actually would magnify the importance of money in the process. And in a district like this one, instead of having a primary where a progressive Democrat has a pretty good chance of winning and then basically wins the seat, you would have a system where that progressive Democrat would face a general election against someone who would try to raise a lot of money from big business and attract Republican votes, Republican-leaning decline to states. Maybe less of a risk right here in San Francisco, but other places in the Bay Area, other places around the state, you would magnify the business influence and the influence of big money. I realize it's not very popular to say this, but I actually think that having strong political parties is good for our system. It's certainly not, the savior of our political system, but there's nothing wrong with having a party which one would hope stands for something and draws the allegiance of people who then vote in a primary to decide who should be the candidate of their party. Another big problem with Prop 14 is it would virtually wipe out third parties. And granted, the third parties are not very strong in California right now, but at least now they have some hope of winning in a general election, whereas if you go with the top two, it almost locks in the control of the reigning two political parties.
Thanks. If you look outside the U.S., in other countries, what are the good examples of ways of financing election campaigns? I know that Europe has a variety of different systems. Trent, have you looked at that?
Well, yeah, most of the European systems do have public finance of campaigns. They have a slightly different system there, where there they generally provide the public financing to the parties as opposed to individual candidates. So you're people are relatively it's difficult for them to get outside of the party, though of course they have multiple parties, so that's less of a problem. But that's probably part of the reason why they have been a little bit more advanced than the United States on the issues of climate change and things like that, because they have not had quite as much influence of corporate campaign expenditures as we do here in California.
Getting back to the specific mechanics of Proposition 15, how much money do you think Prop 15 was successful and that it was expanded to all elected offices in California at a statewide level. How much public money is going to wind up being funneled into that, whether it's through fees on lobbyists or other mechanisms or just general fund? How many millions of dollars are we talking about?
The increased fees on the lobbyists and for those of you who don't know, it's amazing how little lobbyists currently pay for their registration fees here in California. It's $12.50 a year. It's just amazing. It's actually less than the cost of a fishing license for a single day.
It's a different kind of fishing.
Yeah, a different kind of fishing. It raises it to $350 a year, and there are so many that some people say, well, how can $350 a year really add up to enough to fund campaigns? Well, the people that ask that don't understand how many lobbyists there are in Sacramento. There are over 1,200 lobbyists. That's 10 lobbyists, registered lobbyists for every single legislator in Sacramento. There are 3,400 firms that employ lobbyists, so it adds up to about $7 million or so over a four-year period, which happens to be just enough to provide funding for Secretary of State candidates because it's a relatively inexpensive office.
So if you scale that up to governor and everything else, what kind of multiplier would you use?
Well, the funding source of the lobbyist registration fees can really only be used for Secretary of State because Secretary of State registers and tracks their activity. We would have to find some other funding source. But there are other funding sources. Just as an example, for insurance commissioner, there's a study that showed that there's so many insurance contracts in the state of California that like a 30 or 40 cent surcharge on insurance contracts, on each insurance contract, would pay for public financing for all insurance commissioner candidates. So the cost is really relatively small. It's about $5 per person per year for all offices, about the cost of a coffee and a muffin. I used to say the cost of a movie ticket, but those days are long past. So the cost would be very small, and the benefit to the budget of California would be huge.
So in both cases, the idea is to put a tax on the very thing that office is responsible for.
For other statewide offices, yeah.
So this would be
sense.
Kind of let the punishment fit the crime?
Well, let the regulated pay for the regulation, which is okay. What actually happens with fishing licenses, as a matter of fact.
Now, one of the criticisms of Prop 15 by the opposition is that it eliminates the ban on public financing of elections permanently and unequivocally, and it specifically sets up this two campaigns for Secretary of State, and then that's a sunset provision. It goes away after 2018, but the ban on public financing never goes away. So your opposition is saying that's kind of sneaky. So defend yourself.
Well, the opposition certainly has been trying to make hay out of that. I don't think they've been very successful because the whole idea of a pilot project is that it can be expanded if it's successful. And that is the very idea of Proposition 15. We believe that the pilot project for Secretary of State will be successful. It does sunset if for any reason it does not work, then it will sunset in 2018. And what's the harm done other than lobbyists have to pay additional fees for a few years? But nobody will ask to publicly finance other offices. But if it does work, it could completely transform our broken campaign finance system by getting politicians out of the fundraising game and changing the system for environmental policy, for health care, for schools, and everything else.
One of the another point your opposition makes is that the voters have rejected public campaign financing twice in just the last few years. So why go to all the trouble of asking them again? They've already said no.
Well, the things have changed quite dramatically, as we've seen since the past public financing things have happened. We are now still in, if not just barely getting out of, the Great Recession that was caused clearly by rampant deregulation due to hundreds of millions of dollars in campaign contributions from Wall Street. People are seeing how that has hurt our country. People are seeing the huge health care battle over a year. Also, nobody's satisfied with those results, and also that was clear that was coming from campaign contributions. We see the BP oil spill, the lack of regulation of the oil industry caused by, again, tens of millions of dollars of campaign contribution and absolute destruction wreaked because of that. So now you see that poll after poll say that people want to see major changes in the way we finance election campaigns. And that is why an October poll of Proposition 15 showed that voters at that point supported Proposition 15 by nearly a 3-to-1 margin.
Right. If campaign limits, if public financing came in for most offices, what kind of behavioral changes would you expect? And I think Bill would be the best one to answer this on the part of, the part of the legislators. Or what different kind of behavior would you expect from our public officials?
Something that I think most people don't realize is just the sheer amount of time that your public officials are spending raising money. My wife and I have lately been watching the HBO show The Wire, which we don't get HBO, so we're watching it after it's over on Netflix. And there's this one great scene in there. There are a lot of great scenes, but the one I'm thinking of, this guy is running for mayor of Baltimore, and his campaign consultant shuts him in a room and says, don't come out until you've raised $30,000. And he's just in there with his list and the phone. And you see him in there trying to think of everything he can do besides making those phone calls asking people for money. Because I hear that there's a few of these politicians who actually like making those calls, but, you know, most of them, it's not really fun. But they have to do it. That was a realistic type of scene. When I talk to candidates, they tell me that's how they're spending most of their time. They call it dialing for dollars. Of course, they're not going to tell you, yeah, this is how I spend my time. But that is actually what they have to do. Now, imagine if they were able to spend that time actually in the service of the people who they represent. So that's one huge change I think we'd see. Another, of course, would be when they make that choice of which phone call to return. Now, I don't think that any company that employs people is going to have trouble getting their phone calls returned by an official who represents the people that they employ. I mean, come on. Of course, they're going to be able to talk to their elected official. No problem. It's just, should that be based on, you know, employment, or should it be based on a campaign contribution that might be coming from a company that doesn't employ any people in that person's district? I mean, what we see in Sacramento is a guy from Los Angeles suddenly taking up the cause of the agriculture industry. And, you know, it's not because he's concerned about his constituents getting good food. It's because he's getting campaign contributions. So, you know, why shouldn't he be representing the interests of his own constituents instead of the campaign contributors? And then, of course, we think we'd see a real change in the actual voting behavior. That on a lot of these tough votes, where, as I said, you kind of got the three blocks. You got, you know, the ones you know are with you, the ones you know are against you. Then you got those ones in the middle who, if they can think they can get away with it, they'll take the money. That would be a much reduced part of the equation. And I think they'd be more looking at what do their constituents want. And so I think we would get actually better public policy from those officials. And not only legislators, but if you look at those in the executive branch who are enforcing the laws, you know, what if the federal regulators had strictly enforced the safety rules on offshore oil drilling? Then, you know, they wouldn't have let BP just run amok. So I think it would make a real difference in public policy. Again, it wouldn't solve all of our problems, but this is kind of the fundamental reform that we need.
Thanks, Bill. I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our topic is campaign finance reform and the environment. Our speakers are Bill McGavern of Sierra Club, California, and Trent Lang of the Yes on 15 campaign and also the California Clean Money campaign. We just have time for one last question. And let me ask Trent this question. What are your chances? And are you a perpetual optimist or what? I mean, I understand you got beat up this morning on KQED pretty well.
Yes, yes. Well, you have to be a perpetual optimist in this. And so far, it's we have had reasons to be optimistic. I mean, it took 5 long years to get the legislature to put this on the ballot through each year getting stomped down, but getting one step further as more and more grassroots people demanded it. We have the good polling numbers. We're having endorsements from over 400 organizations and leaders in the state of California, from the League of Women Voters of California, California Common Cause, AARP, Consumer Federation of California, Sierra Club California, all the leading environmental groups. So there's been a lot of momentum. Most of the major newspapers have been endorsing Proposition 15. On the other hand, you see that the lobbyists have friends in what one might say low places. All of the paid slate mailers, except for 3 of them, you know, those ones that try to pass themselves off as being the environmental slate mailer, the official Democratic or Republican Party slate mailer, but they're just selling out to the highest bidder, they are all friends of the lobbyists, and they have all basically given away No on 15 positions to their lobbyist friends, which means there's going to be about 20 to 25 million pieces of mail out there saying No on 15. So that's a challenge. And that's a challenge that we are only going to be able to beat by working as absolutely hard as we possibly can in these last couple of weeks in the election. And I know many, many people, and I'm looking at some of you right now in this audience, are working as absolutely hard as you can. So I think our chances are good, but we've got to fight this every step of the way until Proposition 15 gets passed.
Thanks, Trent. Well, that's all we have time for, so please join me in thanking our panelists this evening, Bill McGavern of Sierra Club, California, and Trent Lang of Yes on 15. I'm Kerry Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.